Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Danforth, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, where he has written widely about Turkey, U.S. foreign policy, and the Middle East. He has co-authored a new report at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Danforth.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, and the Council on Europe have criticized the campaigns, the government of Turkey, the extent to which the playing field was anything but level. And in terms of the dark cloud of illegitimacy, of course, it's pretty clear where the vote monitors come down. But then President Erdogan, in his typical, you know, arrogant posture, has told the vote monitors, know your place, know your place, like some sort of school mom. So that doesn't bode well, does it?
No. You know, maybe what we should have written is there are a number of dark clouds. Two in particular, I think, as you mentioned, one, even before the voting started, it was clear this wasn't going to be a legitimate referendum. The fact that people were arrested while campaigning for no, the fact that the distribution of airtime on public TV stations was so uneven, the fact that in a climate of fear where so many journalists had been arrested, no one could speak honestly about this. I mean, this was going to be an illegitimate referendum going into it. Then on top of that, you have this whole added question of were there actually irregularities in the conduct of the vote itself? Was there ballot stuffing? And when shortly after the polls closed, the Turkish Electoral Commission basically came out and said, for various reasons, we're actually going to count votes that don't have the proper markings on them, that, you know, that raised a lot of concerns, which still are very far from being answered.
Well, I mean, if you run a campaign where you basically say, I'm your savior, and I'm going to make things great and make us make Turkey great again. and you're all going to get rich. And by the way, the other side are a bunch of terrorists. I mean, isn't that the campaign?
Yeah. And there was a particularly remarkable moment where Erdogan actually went to the trouble of saying, I'm not saying everyone who's voting no is a terrorist, but it's worth noting that all the terrorists are voting no. I mean, that was the level of dialogue here. Exactly. And that, you know, yeah, that just makes it impossible for anyone to, you know, to think that even in the best case scenario, even if Erdogan had won with a more convincing majority, that this could actually give him the kind of legitimacy which, you know, he both craves, but then behaves in a way to make it absolutely impossible for him to achieve.
So what leverage is there? I mean, he probably, you know, in that, what, several hundred room palace that he's built for himself, he's probably in the privacy of his own thoughts, might recognize that this is not exactly a ringing endorsement. All the major cities voted against him. It's just the people in the countryside that voted for him. And then we don't know how much he rigged the vote in any case. And we certainly know that it was totally unfair. And he pulled out all the stops to rig it in his favor in the first place. So they were expecting, from what I understand, the Erdogan and the AKP people were expecting to win by over 60%, weren't they?
You know, and that's the part that seems fascinating. Right. I think they honestly might have expected that they could win fairly. I mean, again, given all the previous questionable behavior. But, of course, when it became clear that they weren't going to be able to win fairly, it seems, you know, again, we're still waiting for the full evidence to come out, that they would also, well, they'd rather win it unfairly than lose. You know, right, the question if Erdogan doesn't actually, you know, come out of this with the kind of support that he wanted, the kind of confidence that he wanted, you know, how that affects his thinking. We, looking at it from the outside, obviously see the story of him increasing his power, him becoming more successfully authoritarian, eliminating any threats to his rule. But at the same time, the situation, from his point of view, probably he's much less confident in his hold on power. You know, he barely survived a coup attempt last summer. As you know, we saw from the vote, there's certainly a lot of people in the country who don't like him. And it's precisely because of that insecurity, I think, that he, you know, if you alluded to, feels still that the kind of divisive, the kind of paranoid, the kind of very aggressive politics that we've come to expect from him over the last few years are likely to continue.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center, who has written widely about Turkey, U.S. foreign policy, and the Middle East. He has co-authored a new report at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote. So what leverage then does the rest of the world have, not to mention the 49% of people that voted against him in Turkey? I'm not sure that he cares. I mean, he's tried to demonize the rest of the world, and particularly Europe, hasn't he? I mean, he's played on right. sort of nationalism, and that seems to have worked to some extent. So we can expect that to continue. But in terms of actual the levers of leverage, if you will, what's the situation vis-a-vis refugees? Can he really cause trouble in Europe?
You know, that's a good question, right? There's been this narrative that at the end of the day, Europe's desperate to appease Erdogan because at any minute he can unleash this flood of refugees on them. This is not my area of expertise, but from what I understand, there are, you know, there are political circumstances out of Erdogan's control that have made Europe less attractive to refugees, have limited the number of people that would be trying to make the crossing from Turkey into Greece. Anyways, and so I think there's a sense, you know, in European political circles that that's not quite the threat that it used to be for Erdogan.
And is there any likelihood that he will show any humility and deal more reasonably and rationally with Europe? Because it sounds like when he's threatening to bring back the death penalty, and that's a red line as far as joining the EU is concerned, what do you make of that? Do you think he's bluffing or is he serious?
Well, this seems like the biggest paradox to me, that on one hand, you know, you certainly have people in the Turkish government that realize in the long term to make the prosperous, stable, powerful Turkey that they dream of, you know, that they have to be on good terms with Europe, that they have to have a functioning economic relationship with Europe, that they have to be pragmatic, you know, domestically too, that they have to resolve their issue with their own Kurdish constituency. You know, they realize all this, but at the same time, as you said, their domestic political success, their ability to win, you know, fairly or not, referendums like this has been a product of, you know, very aggressive nationalistic, you know, what I'm calling the European fascists. So, you know, how Erdogan is going to be able to reconcile the kind of broader long-term foreign policy needs for the country versus his domestic political interests, you know, which would push for a much more aggressive approach to Europe, you know, that's going to be difficult for him to resolve. And based on what we've seen, you know, he's going to prioritize domestic political success over the long-term good of the country.
So is there any U.S. policy here? I mean, it's difficult to find out what U.S. foreign policy is. You've got the 36-year-old son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has most of the portfolios. I'm sure Turkey's one of them. In fact, he visited Turkey. By the way, they kept mentioning in these talks the PKK, and Jared thought that was some kind of medical issue they were talking about. He didn't even know what the acronym for PKK was. So maybe he's learned a little bit more. And Tillerson seems to be completely marginalized. So what do you know there in Washington at the Bipartisan Policy Center? What do you know about U.S. policy? And, I mean, now that General Flynn's out of the picture, he took $500,000 from Erdogan's bagman. So that...
Well, and that's what... Yeah, I mean, that's what makes it so difficult to make sense of. I mean, on one hand, the State Department's initial response after the election seemed, I thought, very good. You know, they said, we're going to wait for the OSCE report on the election to come out before we comment. Then the report came out, was very critical, emphasized all the irregularities, and shortly afterwards, Trump called Erdogan to congratulate him. So, yeah, I mean, whatever leverage we may have had, whatever leverage the United States, I think, could have exercised by calling attention to the lack of legitimacy surrounding this referendum, the president seemed very eager to sacrifice and did so very quickly.
So he's going to let this guy stay until, not that the U.S. determines who rules Turkey, but his term of office could extend to 2034. And that's pretty unusual to begin with. So this is just Trump basically making a choice for transactional politics over democratic values?
You know, and unfortunately, I have to say, when it comes to U.S.-Turkish relations, there's a long history of that. When, you know, it was recently the anniversary of the Truman Doctrine, when the United States welcomed Turkey as an ally against the Soviet Union. And when you look at the way Truman actually phrases his speech about Greece and Turkey, welcoming them into what would eventually go on to be the NATO alliance, you know, he makes it very clear. He praises Greek democracy, and he doesn't actually ever use the word democracy in connection with Turkey. Turkey wasn't a democracy when we started giving aid to it in 1948. Subsequently, Turkey has had a series of coups on the United States. You know, I made it clear that we prefer to see Turkey as a democracy, but we've simultaneously made it clear that being democratic is not a requirement for NATO membership, and that it's not a requirement for us to continue having good relations with Turkey, as long as, and I guess this is an important caveat, they're supporting our foreign policy interests. And so the question, you know, now will be, given that, you know, there's a lot of grounds for the U.S. and Turkey to work together, there are also a lot of areas where we don't see eye to eye. And what I'm worried about is that it may be, you know, if Turkey stops doing what we want in northern Syria against ISIS, then in a very hypocritical way, we might belatedly pull out this democracy card for more instrumental rather than principled reasons.
Well, clearly we tolerated, if not encouraged, these military governments, right? And that was the
exactly.
unfortunate legacy. And of course, that more recent coup, as amateurish as it was, reminded everybody of that long struggle for democracy. But that in itself makes you scratch your head and wonder, why did the Turkish people sign away their democracy?
You know, I think that's one of the things that when you look at the way, well, I guess when you look at the way this looks to people in Turkey, for, you know, diehard Erdogan supporters, they've, in the past, they've seen the threat to their democracy come from the military. You know, we don't know the details of the coup last summer, but they've seen the threat to their democracy come from, you know, most likely members of the Gulen movement. And they've seen, because of this history, because of the kinds of threats that Turkish democracy has faced in the past, they've come to see Erdogan as the, you know, the one protecting their democracy against those threats. And so, you know, even as he stops behaving democratically or starts behaving in a, you know, what at best could be called a very illiberal majoritarian style of government, they, you know, they nonetheless see him as the kind of democratic alternative, the manifestation of the will of the people in the face of these myriad threats. You know, fewer and fewer people, I think, continue to see it that way. But, you know, the numbers who still did were just close enough that maybe with some fudging, they added up to 51.5%.
So what do you think the 49%, which might well have been a majority because of the vote rigging and the fact that these unmarked, unstamped ballots, suddenly they decided to, I mean, how could you do that? You know, it was a pretty simple ballot, wasn't it? You had yes or no, and you stamped one box or the other. And how would they allow unstamped ballots to be counted? Did they just decide where to put the stamp?
Yeah, so the argument was that because a couple election officials hadn't been properly trained, they submitted ballots that hadn't been properly stamped. And that because the Electoral Commission was so concerned that by not counting these improperly stamped ballots, they disenfranchise, you know, however many couple hundred people might have been in these districts where the election officials made this mistake. The only response to this, the only fair thing to do would be to, you know, basically change longstanding electoral law and open up the ballots to any, you know, and again, there's no evidence that, well, that's fine. No one knows, you know. There are a lot of things that could be on these unstamped ballots, and once you open that up, there's no longer any mechanism, I mean, that's what the stamp was supposed to be for, to ensure that the ballots that are being counted are ones that were legitimately cast and not ones that were stuffed into a box somewhere.
But again, going back to the minority who lost narrowly but could well have been a majority because of the rigging that took place. And certainly, had there been a level playing field in terms of the other side being able to campaign, have access to the media, not be operating in a climate of oppression and fear, with journalists being jailed right, left and centre, and anybody that campaigned for the No campaign was called a terrorist and likened to a terrorist. What do the urban, educated Turks do now? How do they, I mean, they can't possibly put up with this guy until 2034.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the near future, Turkey's stability certainly in the next couple of years is going to depend on how people who are unhappy with this result respond. And, you know, there's certainly some people were talking about how there'd be large protests if the evidence of fraud looks more obvious. Then you certainly could have people coming out on the street, which, you know, the government might deal with very harshly. At the same time, you seem to have a lot of people who are willing to hunker down, resign themselves to the fact that they don't have any good options for fighting back. You have a lot of people who are, you know, making plans to leave the country. So I guess in the short term, you know, a lot depends on how people respond. In the longer term, too, you know, Turkey's going to face, it could potentially face economic crises. It could, you know, I mean, particularly a looming economic crisis, given some of the indicators, could have an ongoing war against the PKK. You know, there are a lot of things that, you know, even if there is some short-term stability, even if, you know, the immediate aftermath of the referendum, the opposition is kind of resigned to Erdogan's victory, you know, there are still things that could destabilize the situation in the medium term.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Nicholas Danforth.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
And likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Security Program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He has written widely about Turkey, the U.S. foreign policy, and the Middle East, and has co-authored a new report at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Dark Cloud of Illegitimacy Hovers Over Turkey Vote. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into alternatives to the collision course the U.S. is on with North Korea.